The other day, Trump stole your tweet about how many ships are headed to the U.S. to pick up that sweet, sweet crude.
So more than double are the typical levels of inbound unladen, so empty tankers. Obviously, the U.S. Gulf Coast gets lots of VLCCs. They're just delivering crude. These ones are empty coming to get crude. The Middle East, functionally still offline. China banning the export of refined products. Kind of the world is shutting down. And the main freest area that still has oil to export and oil available is the United States and North America more broadly. No new oil is being created by these tankers going to the United States. It's the same amount of oil. It's just shuffling around to other areas of the world that are willing to pay more for those same barrels. The highest price he had seen was a barrel of delivered crude oil to Sri Lanka that someone paid $286 a barrel for.
Rory Johnson, oil market researcher and founder of CommodityContext.com. How are you today? Thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So, Rory, I wanted to speak with you today because when Lynn Alden calls you her favorite oil quant, I have to sit up and take notice. And of course, we're going to get into a couple other, notable tweets that have been stolen as of late, later on. But, you know, I feel like it's been such a tumultuous time. Trying to keep up with everything that's happening here is very difficult. And that being said, I've really enjoyed your analysis, and I wanted to kind of get a sense of the current situation by, talking about seeing the lowest OPEC plus output of all time last month. And then the other day, Trump stole your tweet about how many ships are headed to the U.S. to pick up that sweet, sweet crude. So it seems like Trump has been, in a way, trying to position U.S. to supply the rest of the world. Can they actually supply the shortfall, and for how long?
Yeah, so let's start with the tweet. So that was this past Saturday. I woke up after finally getting to bed a little early on Friday night for the first time in weeks. And I'm like, nice rest. I'll wake up. And then my phone basically exploded on me as soon as I woke up. So that was weird. So let's talk about what the chart, what the map showed. So the map that I posted showed VLCCs, which are the largest main type of tanker. They carry 2 million barrels, typically, of crude. And they are, you know, you have over 90 of them headed right now for the U.S. Gulf Coast. Normally, that number is more like, 20 to 40. So more than double are the typical levels of kind of inbound unladen, so empty tankers. Obviously, the U.S. Gulf Coast gets lots of VLCCs. They're just delivering crude. These ones are empty coming to get crude. So what's going on? So basically, with the Middle East functionally still offline, China banning the export of refined products, kind of the world is shutting down. And the main freest area that still has oil to export and oil available is the United States and North America more broadly. So I'm up here in Toronto and Canada. And together, Canada and the United States currently constitute the most energy secure area on the planet right now, particularly for the mid-continent. So areas through the center of North America, particularly the center of the United States, where you just do not have the same physical capacity for competition that most other areas do. So right now, relatively cheap oil and products in the United States, because the crisis is still just really arriving here. That air pocket took 6 weeks, basically, to arrive in North America. Mm-hmm. Now it's arriving. So with all of these tankers that had previously been waiting for Hormuz to reopen, and we're like, okay, we're ready, we're here, we're waiting, we waited for weeks, wasn't opening. They're like, okay, well, we need to do something. Tanker rates are sky high. Let's go make use of our assets. So they all steamed around, and now they're heading across the Atlantic, around the Horn of Africa, up to the U.S. Gulf Coast. Obviously, I think Trump picked up on this because a lot of the commentary, and the tweet went a little viral even before he picked it up, which I'm assuming is how he saw it in the first place. Mm-hmm. And I should also say, this is a map that I was throwing in my weekly report that I publish every Friday. I literally spent, 20 seconds on the tweet itself. So that's always a good reminder. Never know where your tweets are going to go. So I think he was very much, you know, coming at this from a U.S. energy dominance, you know, rah, rah, USA, you know, strongest in the world, if anything, may actually benefit from the Hormuz closure. I think this is the narrative that's trying to kind of be ginned up here. The downside is the reason, or downside from the president's perspective, the reason those tankers are all coming to the United States is because other people around the world are willing to pay much more for U.S. oil than U.S. consumers are. That means, ipso facto, if the United States wants to continue consuming petroleum, it's going to need to pay more and more and more for it, which means rising pump prices. It means kind of across the board increases in energy prices. Mm-hmm. That's the downside to that tweet. And I think the part that the White House is probably not going to highlight. If I'm a betting man, I haven't seen them pick up any of my tweets talking about, upward pressure on North American product prices. But that's how this market is trying to solve right now. And the other thing I want to stress, because other people are like, there's been a big cadre of commentators that, and I think we can spend almost the entire talk talking about the weird market reaction to this crisis thus far. Mm-hmm. And there's a cadre of market commentators that, combined with U.S. exports are going to rise, look, prices are down. Therefore, look, we never needed Hormuz in the first place. This was all kind of oil analyst hocus pocus. Like, this is nonsense. No new oil is being created by these tankers going to the United States. It's the same amount of oil. It's just shuffling around to other areas of the world that are willing to pay more for those same barrels. I think that's the distinction here that's important, is this is just what this is showing is not the United States necessarily coming to the rescue, but the rest of the world coming for U.S. barrels, right? They're like, we want these. And as long as, like, one of the worries we had initially, I would say still say lingering if this continues, is that the United States would limit trade in some way. We had seen, obviously, prior to Obama's repeal in 2016, the U.S. had a decades-long ban on the export of crude oil. I could have seen the same thing being applied to refined products. Now, thus far, we have not. And I think in some ways, if there's one silver lining to my tweet being stolen by the president, hopefully it means that he's really proud of these export volumes and he's not going to restrict trade. Because if trade gets restricted, that's really big problem in a market where the U.S. is the only real available swing supplier left. So more, I think that's how this is going to kind of solve out.
More resource nationalism, if you will.
Exactly.
So, Rory, when we're seeing, you know, it's almost, let's say, double to triple the amount of tankers coming to the U.S., how long can they sustain that output for? And is it possible that they dip into the SPR to supply all of those tankers?
Almost surely. Some of the SPR releases are going to end up exported. Mm-hmm. That is just almost a guarantee. Unless there are specific controls put in place that I have not seen that requires that they be consumed by a U.S. refinery or whatever. And then even then, there's nothing to say the products yielded from those refineries aren't then exported. So I think at this stage, it's one market. Now, part of the weirdness of this market, normally we approach the market as one market because functionally it is that trade fills in these holes and smooths out these kind of inconsistencies and imbalances across the world. So, like, that's what we talk about, you know, 105 million barrel a day market, supply and demand, you know, we've got our global balance. Normally, the oil market moves really slowly. Like, obviously, futures prices and everything, they'll trade on a dime. But as we were saying, it takes weeks and weeks, months for a barrel of oil to transit an ocean to get from place, you know, point A to point B. And the industry itself, you know, investment takes a long time, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But one of the weirdnesses we're having right now is that you're seeing these local acute shortages emerge in areas that had been core importers of fuel from the Middle East prior to the war. Mm-hmm. And it's taking time because of how rapidly and aggressively those shortages emerged in these consuming and importing jurisdictions, it takes time to fill that hole. So I think, like, as an example, I tweeted earlier this morning, last night there was a quote from HSBC's CEO that noted that there was the highest price he had seen was a barrel of delivered crude oil to Sri Lanka that someone paid $286 a barrel for. So I think this is the key, right? Is that obviously WTI is not trading anywhere near that. WTI Brent even is below $100 a barrel right now on the prompt, like on the prompt futures price that most people look at as the price of Brent. I think that's the other thing that's really weird here is that, again, given how aggressive and sharp the supply loss was, the vast majority of the pricing pressure has occurred at the very, very front of the curve through exploded backwardation. You had, you know, as an example, it's down from these highs now, but when we, you know, 2 weeks ago, we had WTI prompt time spreads, which are the kind of the spread between the first contract and the second contract, rose to an all-time high of $15 a barrel, which is normally we talk about prompt spreads in cents per barrel. Like a strong prompt time spread is like $1 a barrel. That's a strong one. Like, you know, that's when we were at the peak in like the 12-day war last year between Israel and Iran, we were seeing kind of low single-digit dollars of kind of backwardation. That is exceptional, but within the realm of normalcy. What we're seeing right now is not normal. It is completely outside all of our normal expectations for how this market would clear. And as an example, with, you know, I also posted kind of a tweet that showed a chart that basically showed the futures curve as you would normally expect for Brent, but then extended that futures curve with what we call the CFD or the contracts for difference curve for physical delivered barrels, basically various weeks forward from, you know, spot Brent pricing. So when for dated Brent, which is the kind of main physical benchmark, with, you know, Brent prompt futures right now under $100, dated Brent as of yet last night was trading at over $130 a barrel. So you're seeing a more than a $30 spread for effectively a month and a half, 2 months of kind of delivered difference, which is, you can view this in one of two ways. And I think lots of people are viewing it in both ways. The one way of viewing this is through a more kind of traditional view of the market, which is, okay, so the market is betting, the market's assuming that this will be short-lived. So you're seeing all the pressure in the prompt and nothing, because by, you know, right now, prompt Brent futures are trading for June barrels. Surely this will be over by June, you know, they say. I would have said as well. I'm much less confident now. But that's one assumption. I think the other way of viewing this, though, is through the way I typically think about these markets, which is that you have basically, the primary purpose of term structure or the shape of the futures curve is physical spot market clearance. So when you have way too much oil, it's actually easier to start with an oversupplied market, which actually, just to be clear, we had an oversupplied market immediately before this war.
Yeah.
I think the other thing that's bizarre is that a lot of people have accused me over the last 6 weeks of being a permabull, which is strange for anyone that's followed me for more than 6 weeks, because typically, I am labeled a perma bear in the oil market. I think that's a strong statement. I don't think I'm a perma bear. I don't think I'm a perma anything. I think as this example has proven, I just follow the data. So prior to the war start, we had at least 2 million barrels a day of oversupply in the global oil market. And the front of the futures curve was beginning to come under increased pressure. And essentially, when you have too much oil, and like we can think about this in the example of, let's say, the bottom of the market in 2020 in April, when prices hit negative levels for the first time in history. When you have too much supply and not enough demand, you essentially get more and more of a discount kind of borne by prompt or kind of spot delivered barrels. And I think that's the important thing to think about here is it's not that you're paying a premium for future day barrels, it's that you're demanding or commanding a discount on spot versus future. I think that's the important direction of kind of causality, if you will. And the reason those discounts are important is because when you have an oversupplied market, well, we always talk about production and consumption mismatching. Supply and demand in any given moment needs to equal one another. If someone's supplying a barrel, someone needs to take it. Otherwise, nothing happens with it, right? So
that's when we get a situation like we had in COVID, right? When the oil price actually went negative.
It is. And that's basically that at that stage, you were running out of inventory space. And that was how the market cleared. But even in like normal oversupplied circumstances, you would still trade this steep contango is what we call it, where the curve is upward sloping. So prompt prices are cheaper than future prices. And that difference, that time spread, essentially pays the cost of inventory. So let's say you have a $10 difference between a barrel today and a barrel a year from now. If your cost of storing that barrel is less than $10 a barrel and insurance and everything else over the course of that year, you basically get a risk-free arbitrage. And that's how the market clears. That's how you absorb excess barrels. What happened in 2020 was that everyone ran out of storage and were like, well, even if I wanted to, obviously these are very attractive contango arbitrage opportunities, but I don't have storage. So like, what, I'm going to put it in a swimming pool? Like that. People were literally talking about this at the time. Yeah. In hyper undersupplied markets, it's the opposite. So rather than a discount on spot or near-term barrels, you have an exceptionally high premium on those barrels. And rather than paying for storage, you are basically charging an opportunity cost to holders of storage if they don't want to release their barrels to the market. So if we go back to, let's say, that WTI example where you had a $15 a barrel prompt time spread, unless you were a refiner and you needed that barrel for something specifically that month, you could have basically sold your barrel in storage for May delivery, bought the same barrel back in June for $15 a barrel less, and basically rented the barrel to the market with no risk, and you get the same barrel back by summer. That's essentially what the market's trying to do there. And the challenge is that much of the narrative and the commentary in the market is being driven entirely by futures prices, which are very truly very low in the context of where we're currently trading. Again, Brent right now is 94.73 as I'm looking at the screen right now, which I would say feels low given what we're experiencing. But let's be charitable with the market for a second. Let's say the market's right. How do we explain that weird dislocation? And I think an important starting point is, again, if we go back to February, we had an oversupplied market. We had inventory levels or stock levels globally that had risen to quite high levels. And there was going to be more and more downside pain for crude prices. My expectation was pretty bearish for crude prices over the balance of 2026. The back of the curve, I typically think of as reflecting observed and realized inventory scarcity. We are drawing down inventories very rapidly now, but from still high levels. So what you'd expect in that moment is a relatively placid curve and an exceptionally backwardated front. That is kind of what we're seeing. If this view of the market and this framework is correct, the back of the curve is not going to continue rising until we begin to see those deficits realize in official inventory data. Only then will you begin to price that kind of longer term scarcity and kind of validate the front of the market. But the front of the market is truly what people are actually paying today. So I had even mentioned, $130 dated Brent, which is the benchmark. And then people for actual physical delivery say, I think the last one I saw was for the end of April, for like an end of April, beginning of May loading period, people were bidding more than $20 a barrel physical premium on top of that $130 benchmark. So actual physical delivered barrels in the North Sea are going upwards of $150 a barrel right now versus under $100 for June Brent prompt. So something is going weird, right? So again, either it is just this very bizarre curve structure that is naturally going to moderate once those inventory levels are actually realized as draws, or I'm entirely wrong about how I view the oil market. And there is anticipatory elements or strong anticipatory elements in the forward curve, in the futures curve, that are currently assuming that this is going to end soon. And again, we saw this morning, Trump said, it's basically over. The strait is opening. The strait, as of right now, is not open and the war is not done. And right now they're discussing whether or not to extend the ceasefire further. But as it currently stands, we're still drawing down 13 million barrels a day, roughly, of oil from the global system that would have been produced that's now not. That's the amount, that's the volume of oil that's been shut in across the Gulf, across the six main non-Iranian Gulf producers. And that keeps leaking out of the market every single day that Hormuz remains closed. And so far, it remains closed and not reopened. Mm-hmm.
So is it possible that we're kind of in this Cinderella period for not only the oil market, but also equity markets and even the world economy because of this lag effect and or floating inventory that has been, you know, that isn't either A, allowed to leave the strait, or B, that was already, you know, going on its way to be delivered.
Sorry, and just in terms of how that's sorting through the system?
Yeah, because it seems like, you know, if you took that much energy out of the world, you should have an immediate effect. But, you know, I'm just trying to get a gauge on why this lag effect exists the way that it is precipitating right now in the world.
Yeah, so I think one of the issues here is that the oil market, most of us, even me most of the time, experiences the oil market primarily through the futures market, because this is where the most liquidity is. That's where everyone can see the prices. That's what Bloomberg's reporting on, et cetera, et cetera. But the physical market moves much, much slower than futures imply. You know, again, you're taking for the barrels of oil that were shipped out of Hormuz prior to the start of the war, that last ship is only really just now landing at its expected destination. So you're talking about a month and a half for those barrels to clear off the market. Only then would you really start to see the pinch point for global balances from there. So that started in Asia. And again, it's that air pocket, as I was describing, it hits different regions at different times. It hit East Africa first, then East Asia, then Europe, now North America. That, I think, is the challenge. And I think, again, there's a second lag here that, let's say Asia as an example, which is the main area, the epicenter of this tightness. Now that the tightness is being realized, now they are beginning to bid for barrels from everywhere else. So it takes the moment for them to kind of hit scarcity. And then that scarcity takes time to then spread to other regions. And this is kind of what we're currently experiencing. But all of this moves at the speed of tanker relative to the speed of kind of, you know, tweet or futures contract repricing. But no doubt, I think that like if you're looking at the futures market right now, it looks like this is basically over, or at least rolling over. And that could be true. I hope that's true. But as of yet, we still have not seen Hormuz reopen. And in fact, Hormuz remains more closed now than it was last week, given the blockade that was imposed by the Trump administration.
Well, that's the next part that I want to understand is, what does the blockade actually entail? And also, how important is it to be considering these quote unquote dark ships that turn off their transponders, go through the strait, and then, you know, maybe turn them back on or not?
Yeah. So in terms of the actual impact of the blockade itself, one important thing to remember is that so prior to the war, we had roughly 20 million barrels a day that were flowing through Hormuz. Since then, it's been roughly a 90% reduction, with that 2-ish million barrels a day that's still flowing through Hormuz, maybe 2 to 3. Most of that is Iranian. So one of the weird aspects of this war that would have surprised me, or I expect any other oil analyst, if you had asked them a couple months ago, like, was Iran going to close Hormuz? And then we all said, no, of course not, because that would have been crazy. And if Iran closed Hormuz, would they still be exporting their oil past the U.S. Navy? And the answer, of course not. That's ridiculous. And I think that's been the weird aspect of this war thus far, is that at least at the beginning, the Trump administration took the stance of kind of maximum oil offset and energy offset pain. So they continued to allow Iran to export its oil, because at the end of the day, even if it's Iranian oil, it's still oil. This is actually very similar in some ways to when the Biden administration did not formally kind of impose secondary sanctions on Russian oil exports following the invasion of Ukraine, but rather attempted to keep those volumes in the market, but limit the pricing of them. This is where we got the price cap. So there's actually it's not dissimilar between the two administrations that their priority was to limit the oil market impacts. Yeah. Now, however, following this latest episode, now they've decided to clamp down and blockade the strait, mainly to cut off those 1.5 to 2 million barrels of Iranian flow. If that persists for, you know, let's say, you know, a week or two or more, then you're going to start seeing those Iranian barrels, that Iranian production shut in. So that 13 million barrels a day of Gulf shut-ins goes to 15. One, that's a lot of oil. So at the first level, that makes the current situation worse. That makes the market tighter, all else equal. I think the hope is that it imposes additional pain on Iran, such that it will be more eager to wrap this up faster. I think there's been an argument that Iran hasn't felt any pain at all, at least economically through this, aside from all of the bombings, because they've got, you know, they're still exporting oil and they're getting gangbuster profits for it. In fact, the Treasury had actually waived sanctions on floating Iranian storage for the first month of the war, because, again, they were interested in maximizing the flow of barrels or availability of barrels to the market. Now we're in a situation where they've decided that's no longer the case. So that sanctions waiver reportedly is not going to be extended. And now they're going to be clamping down on exports even further. So if this reopens Hormuz, it's obviously a positive for the global economy. But if it doesn't, then we've just made the situation even tighter. And I think when we think about what is Iran's view here? What is its position? Why is it agreeing to this current state of affairs? If you view Iran's main leverage, and I think it has to be viewed this way, as the closure of Hormuz, mm-hmm. The closure of Hormuz is an accumulating pressure asset that it, you know, each day it remains closed, the situation gets worse, right? We lose that 13 million barrels each and every day. Now, potentially 15 million barrels. That, you know, let's say, you know, if the downside of that was they were being bombed during that period and they had to like live through the bombings, well, this current situation is actually in some ways the best possible scenario for them, where they're not being bombed, they're getting to negotiate with the United States, and all the while the pressure continues to build. Obviously, Donald Trump wanted the strait to be reopened during the, you know, during the moment of the ceasefire. And I would bet that that's actually part of his rationale for imposing this blockade is, well, if you're not going to open it during the ceasefire, then it's going to be totally closed, which is, okay, fine. Iran can be patient here as well. And I think that's going to be the challenge, is which side can be more patient. My bet is that Iran has more patience, given that it's lived under tight, you know, heavy sanctions for, you know, decades now. It's going to have more patience than the Trump administration, which is typically, I think, reasonably viewed as very sensitive to kind of sharp market movements. So should oil prices, I think Iran is probably also a little head scratching as to why Brent is currently below $100. I think they would view their life as much easier if oil prices were much higher. Because again, I doubt that Donald Trump is following dated Brent delivered kind of cargo basis pricing. He's just looking at the price on the screen. He's looking at WTI. And WTI says that this is basically over at the front of the future. So, but there's also this innate irony here that my view from the beginning of this had always been that, you know, I had said, you know, now infamously, that if Hormuz remained closed, we would hit $200 a barrel of oil. I still believe that. And I think people are like, you're wrong. I'm like, well, Hormuz has not remained closed for a prolonged period of time, right? You know, this is if it remains closed, that's the level of prices we would need to destroy demand. But I had also said at the beginning that, like, I did not see us getting that high because I thought Trump would unilaterally withdraw from the war before that level, because he would balk at prices that high and kind of particularly in a midterm year where he was already looking relatively unpopular, or the Republicans were looking relatively unpopular. So there was a lot of reasons that he didn't want $200 oil. So I expected him to pull back. The irony, though, is that every time he announced that the war was ending, we got like a $15 a barrel sell-off on oil, and then you removed the pressure for him to end the war. So there's this paradox of kind of like cyclicality that, like, the market sells off like, Trump's finally talking. And then we lose $15 from crude price on the screen, and then it removes the pressure for him to talk. So we're in this kind of, we've done this now for weeks, all the while. And I think market pricing and sentiment is one thing. We know we are losing these barrels every day that Hormuz remains closed. And over time, those you know, scarcities and deficits continue to mount. So I think as long as this goes on, it seems like it's in Iran's interest. So like there were headlines this morning about Iran potentially, or US and Iran extending the deadline and or extending the ceasefire. And that being viewed as a positive thing for the market, which in one way it is. It's proof that things are not escalating. Things are not devolving into further war. But if this is primarily a crisis of lost time, extending a ceasefire where Hormuz is not open is not helping the problem. It's just delaying kind of the reckoning here.
yeah, the problem of actual energy delivery versus the problem of no bombing kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But, you know, from a geostrategic standpoint, let's say, Rory, is it a big deal that Trump has now signed a major defense deal with Indonesia concerning the Strait of Malacca, which, according to my reading, is more vital to the world than Hormuz, especially more vital to China, especially?
Yeah, so I haven't, very frankly, I haven't followed a lot of the Malacca stuff recently because I've been very much focused on two other straits, being Hormuz and then the Bab el-Mandeb in the Red Sea. But yes, I think like Malacca is also a very critical strait, both for energy imports as well as obviously just the general flow of trade. The Middle East exports a lot. Asia exports a lot more in terms of total stuff. Mm-hmm. But I think that that is going to be very important. And I do think that there's going to be a newfound appreciation for, you know, critical maritime choke points. I think particularly given that we've now had both Hormuz and the Red Sea and the Houthis within the last couple of years. And then, yeah, I think there's going to be a new kind of respect for the precarity of those maritime choke points.
Mm-hmm. Well, the reason I wanted to understand that is because, you know, there's this idea that was brought forward the other day by another guest that China can get all the oil and gas it needs from Russia and possibly, you know, Russia supplying Europe as well. How do you think about that, you know, that possibility of Russia supplying, basically being able to take up these deficits?
Well, I mean, back to this point about, you know, that the flow of ships going to the United States doesn't create new supply. There's no new supply from Russia either. Now, theoretically, Russia could pump a little bit more if it's not being kind of consistently bombed by Ukraine, which is another wrinkle in this kind of plan for Russia to supply the world. You think it was in like the third week of the war? Because obviously, one of the things that I'd stressed is that I saw Russia as the single largest beneficiary of the Iran war, both because of the higher prices, as well as, you know, you had tightened sanctions against Russia pretty extensively through the past kind of 9 months prior to the war, blocking sanctions on Rosneft and Lukoil, punitive tariffs on India or imports of Russian oil. I think all of that together would actually tighten the noose around Russian oil pretty dramatically. And that all got unwound in a matter of weeks. And now India's clamoring for Russian barrels again. Everyone's clamoring for Russian barrels again. And the discounts borne by those barrels had shrunk dramatically. I could note this. You know, President Zelensky in Ukraine could obviously also note this. And I think there's a pro-cyclical element here that as there was a perception that Russia was going to, you know, benefit from these windfall profits from the war, that stepped up Ukrainian pressure on Russia's capacity to export into the global market. So at one point, again, I think it was the third week of the war, Reuters had reported after extensive Ukrainian drone attacks against Novorossiysk in the Black Sea, as well as a couple of Primorsk, et cetera, a couple of the Baltic ports, that upwards of 40% of Russian oil export capacity was offline, which was as Reuters noted at the time, it was the largest disruption to Russia's oil industry since the fall of the Soviet Union, which again, I was like, I already have one like largest oil shock in history. Like I think I can't deal with another one. But I think that there's this pro-cyclical element to this that when the Ukrainians can see Russia benefiting, that's going to further increase their impetus to hit Russia. And when Russia's hit, that further starves the world of supply, which raises prices, which increases the kind of propensity to hit Russia. So yeah, I think that Russia is an important element of this, but they've been very constrained by Ukraine. The other thing I will just note is that when it comes to China, I think one of the talking points that's a little bit driven me insane through this crisis is that this was, because I believe, cards on the table, I believe that Trump did not mean to get into this war, that he did not mean, did not intend for the Hormuz to be closed for 6 weeks. You know, he, for me, has seemed over this war for weeks and weeks and weeks now. Like, he's wanted out. By this stage, I had expected him to be rolling over on Cuba. And very frankly, I think that he had expected to be rolling over on Cuba by now as well. Mm-hmm. But there's a group of people that believes that this was always the plan, that he wanted to close Hormuz because that would starve China, right? That this would starve Asia and kind of flex U.S. military might. This is further kind of buttressed by the tweet that Trump took of the ships going to the U.S. Gulf Coast, like U.S. energy dominance all the way, right? The trouble I have with this critique, because they're like, okay, first we took out Venezuela that was supplying China with discounted oil. And now we're going to take Iran that's discount, you know, supplying China with discounted oil, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. The challenge with this thesis, in my humble opinion, is that all of those discounted suppliers of Chinese oil were only discounted because of Trump's sanctions in the first place. That prior to Trump's impositions of blocking sanctions on PDVSA in 2019, everyone was buying Venezuelan oil for a full market price. China wasn't getting a deal. China only got a deal after they imposed these sanctions. And China's like, I don't care about the sanctions, but everyone else does. So we get kind of a deal out of it. Same with Iranian oil. Same with all these other kind of sanctioned fuels that China benefits only when the U.S. tries to use that economic statecraft to punish an oil exporter, because China is just a facilitator. It's the buyer of last resort of sanctioned barrels. So it's a little bit of this, like, it's kind of similar to now that Trump's like, we've reopened the strait. Like, it wasn't closed before the war. You can't take credit for reopening it now. That wasn't one of the initial victory goals. Yeah. And I think the same thing is here with China. It's like, sure, but you were the one that had had created the situation that put all of these discounted barrels into China in the first place. So I don't buy it, but I do think that there's a large group of people that firmly believe that this is all part of a grand strategy to kind of strangle Asian energy access and kind of, you know, bolster and kind of flex U.S. energy dominance.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rory, when we understand that the U.S. is supposed to be the biggest exporter of oil, they're also a major importer of oil. So how does that, let's say that the weights of oil work, and how does Venezuela fit into, you know, maybe a strategy there that is able to offset some of the lighter crude that the U.S. produces versus the heavier crude that Venezuela has?
Yeah, so U.S. right now is the largest producer of crude and refined products in the world, but it only produces 13, 14 million barrels a day of crude oil. And it exports a lot of that because it's all very light sweet, as you noted, and it imports others because basically it needs medium and heavy sours to blend into its refineries. Of the crude oil imported in the United States, roughly 2/3 of that comes from Canada, and a very small amount comes from everywhere else, including obviously Venezuela now. That I think is important here because the United States does have some supplies to like leak into the global market, as we're going to be seeing in very radical fashion when these tankers arrive and pick up their cargoes. But it also has access to a lot of kind of like privileged access in this case to a lot of very local sources of kind of captive supply. Now, Venezuelan and Mexican barrels aren't captive per se, but they are very close. And in a physical commodity market, particularly one that's defined by that exceptional backwardation I had mentioned, the other important thing about that backwardation is I kind of think about it as like the time value of crude. If you have a really long shipping time, let's say it takes a month for you to ship a product from point A to point B, you as the shipper are eating that backwardation because the value of that crude over that month, again, in the WTI case for that at that peak was $15 a barrel. Even now you're looking at kind of like, you know, it's less now, but you're looking at like $4 a barrel for prompt Brent. That needs to be factored in. So that makes nearby shipments that much more attractive and economical because you're not eating that. So in that sense, you have these like captive close barrels in the U.S. Gulf Coast. And then also in the Canadian case, the vast majority of those barrels are literally captive. They can't go anywhere else. They're going to get an uplift, and they have gotten an uplift from pricing on a global crude basis. But even if they didn't, it's not like you can get all of those barrels down to the U.S. Gulf Coast for re-export. They kind of get trapped and clogged up in the Midwest refining system. So that, I think, is something that, like, yeah, the U.S. is going to remain relatively energy secure, even with these, what will likely end up being booming exports. But particularly at the coasts, you're going to see the pricing pain, which is back to the kind of political blowback should this continue. Mm-hmm.
Rory, on the other side of this, you know, we've talked about crude a lot, but, you know, LPG is also, you know, a major source of energy, you know, heat, cooking fuel for the rest of the world. How much has that been taken offline, especially from Qatar?
Yeah, so of the 20 million barrels a day that were previously flowing through Hormuz, roughly 15 million was crude oil proper. And then the other 5 million was refined products. Now, that was give or take probably 2 million barrels a day of middle distillates, so jet fuel, diesel, et cetera. And the balance was largely natural gas liquids. So this is kind of what you're talking about, the lighter ends, pet chem feed, LPG for cooking fuel, et cetera. It, depending on the region that you're going to, in India, as an example, one of the unique things about the Indian market is between a fifth and a quarter of Indian consumption of petroleum is actually in LPG. And unlike, let's say, Korea or China, where most LPG is used in pet chem feed, most in India is used as like physical cooking fuel, which is why you have a very different human impact. Like, it's one thing to say, like, we've run out of pet chem feed. It's another thing to say, like, we can't cook food. Very different human impacts, which is why some of the earliest, you know, bilateral deals we saw to clear ships going through Hormuz under Iran's control was actually from Prime Minister Modi, who basically, you know, implored Tehran to like loosen these restrictions and allow these LPG tankers to access the Indian market to kind of stave off that catastrophe. So I think that is something that's going to continue. And we are seeing pet chem feeds tighten, and we're seeing the kind of delivered prices, physical delivered prices of all of these, you know, ethylene or polyethylene or all of these other kind of pet chem outputs skyrocketing as well. So that is something that has additionally tightened the market on top of the, what we would normally think of as the kind of, you know, transportation fuels, gasoline, diesel, jet, et cetera.
So Rory, how much infrastructure has been basically taken offline at this point indefinitely? You know, it seems to me that if we look at the market, or let's say an uneducated view on the market could be, as soon as peace is restored, then the world can go back to normal, oil prices can come down, there's no you know, there's no more threat to feeding people, as we just talked about. But, you know, how much, in your estimation, how much of this energy that was coming out of the Middle East and through the Strait of Hormuz has now been taken offline to a point that it's going to take months plus to be able to rebuild that infrastructure?
So let's separate it into two questions. So I think the most of that 13 million barrels a day that's been shut in across the Gulf, at least in my treatment, is assuming to be not fundamentally damaged, most of it. And in based on reports and comments from most notably the Kuwait Petroleum Corporation CEO at Sierra Week a couple weeks ago, he was saying that it was going to take them basically 3 to 4 months to get back up to full production capacity after Hormuz reopens. I've been modeling that optimistically as essentially 3 months and fairly aggressive on that recovery. So basically 70% first month, 20% second, 10% third month. Assuming all of that, you know, so far we've already lost 450, give or take, million barrels of supply that would have been produced that otherwise now won't. Mm-hmm. I had modeled that if the war ended at the end of April, and Hormuz opened on the first day of May full tilt, and everything started re-ramping at that point. In total, with that re-ramp and the barrels we already lost, we're looking at ballpark 1 billion barrels of oil that was supposed to be produced this year that's now not going to be produced. To your question about more durable physical damage, some of that will likely be more durable. And I think the most notable piece of that that we can kind of be assured off the gate are some of the natural gas liquids that would have been coming from Qatar. The most notable destruction of an asset of capacity that we've seen through this war so far was when Iran attacked the Rosneft LNG facility in Qatar in retaliation for Israel's strikes on the South Pars gas field. That would have been 3 weeks ago, I want to say. Again, losing track of time of how many weeks have passed. But that attack, relative to this kind of, you know, 3 to 4 months we're talking about for to restart upstream, the Qatar Energy CEO told Reuters that that was looking more like a 17% reduction in Qatar's LNG export capacity for up to 5 years. So that, I think, is the ultimate risk here, is that if we see not just Hormuz remain closed, but we see attacks on upstream infrastructure that make this more of a durable crisis that shifts that recovery from weeks to months to years. Thus far, we haven't had that, very thankfully. So we're still avoiding the worst of it. And if Hormuz can reopen, yeah, we can avoid the worst of the apocalypse here. It's going to be painful still. It's going to be very bumpy and dislocated, but it's not going to be the apocalypse. But if we took that stuff off for years, then basically like acute global recession in various areas of the world, global depression kind of guaranteed. I think we're still not there yet, thankfully. The other aspect here that I think is interesting is that we have seen, we haven't seen that many attacks confirmed on upstream assets. We have seen plenty of attacks confirmed on downstream assets. So refineries, petrochemical facilities, et cetera. So I think one of the interesting things is that when Hormuz reopens, one of the things I'll be watching is how much crude oil are they loading and how much refined product are they loading? Because so far, the Gulf monarchies have remained pretty tight-lipped about the extent of damage. So we're not going to fully know until they try and turn everything back on and they try and start loading ships again. If they're loading crude only, probably means pretty extensive refinery damage. But if they are able to get, you know, diesel and jet fuel back onto these tankers, then that's a sign that, you know, that damage, they were able to either repair it in the interim period or it wasn't as bad as feared. But I think that's going to be the other element here, is that most of the worst hits to infrastructure were actually from the downstream rather than the upstream.
So that's talking about it from the, you know, the physical structure standpoint, the molecule standpoint. But what about from the, let's say, the economic standpoint, Rory? You mentioned earlier that you had one energy shock in your life and you don't necessarily want to go through another. What does, you know, Brent crude hitting a new all-time high, very, very recently here, what does that mean for the markets going forward here, you know, both from an energy and a financial standpoint?
If what we're talking about right now is just prices, if we're able to satisfy most demand, but just at higher prices to reflect the near-term scarcity, and if Hormuz reopens, we can avoid the worst of this, and it would just basically manifest as a short-term kind of temporary tax on the world. It would shift value around. So obviously, you know, Texas and New Mexico will have like a booming couple of months, whereas let's say New York and LA will not, and they'll kind of feel the pain. If that's it, then yeah, this is just going to be a painful temporary episode. If we do not reopen Hormuz and you need to start realizing 10 plus million barrels a day of demand destruction, which again, no other source of demand can feed into this market to offset that on a timeline that is viable. Mm-hmm. Even the United States, as an example, because people are like, well, can't U.S. shale just ramp up really quickly? Yes, but we're talking a difference of scale here, that in its all-time high period of growth, U.S. liquids production growth grew year over year. And this is the fastest any country in the world's history has ever grown production. They grew by 2 million barrels a day in 2018, year over year. We're talking about 10. So that, I think, is kind of the scale of what we're talking about that's very, very tricky to solve, which is why you would need to force demand destruction in order to close that hole so we don't basically draw inventories down to nothing. Because they can't. That's the other thing. People are like, oh, well, we've got how many inventories? You know, divide that by the deficit. How many is we can't draw down all inventories. That's not how the system works. But if that's sustained, you need to basically destroy 10 million barrels a day of demand. That is when, yeah, the situation gets pretty dire pretty quick. Because now you're not just talking about prices. You're talking about a mad bid for a competing who can have those final barrels. So at the one level, that tax, that shock of, you know, disposable income, for instance, is much, much worse than it would have otherwise been. You know, we're not talking about 100, we're not talking about 150. We're talking about, like, you know, much, much, much higher prices. There was, as an example here, so that the CEO of HSBC just confirmed a $286 a barrel clearance price, which is, again, just a wild number. That, I think, is where you get far worse impacts to advanced economies and to emerging markets, the countries that can't afford those high-priced barrels. Then you just have you have gas stations that run out of fuel. You have airports that don't have jet fuel. You have you have groceries that can't get across the country because there's not enough diesel. Like, this is where you have people that can't, they have to return to burning wood or biomass to cook because they don't have LPG. Like, that's where the situation gets very, very dire very, very quickly. And again, I still think we avoid that outcome. But I think it's important to keep that in our minds as what the stakes are here. They're like, oh, that's a forecast. It's not a forecast. It's a warning. It's just saying, if this remains closed, that's the type of world we would need to see. And again, people are like, okay, historic sensitivities on price structure. Let's say you get a 10% increase in prices that reduces, you know, by 1% demand. All of these historical sensitivities are pretty useless because we've never needed to cut that deep down the demand curve before. We don't really truly know in a realized way how steep pricing needs to be to force out not just 1-2% of global demand, which is normal. When we're talking about global demand destruction, that's what we're normally talking about. Like in 2022, that's the kind of undersupply we're talking about. Now we're talking about 10-15%. That is a very, very different, it's such a different thing in scale. It's a different thing in kind. So we're going to see what that goes. And the awkward thing about it is it's not just going to be one price, because it's not just crude that's going to do the lifting. Each of these individual product markets has its own thresholds for demand destruction. So what's the price you need to kill, let's say, 3 million barrels a day of diesel demand, 1 million barrels a day of jet fuel demand, 2 million barrels a day of gasoline demand, and then naphtha and LPG and all the way down the curve. And each of those is going to be a different clearance price. And again, we can guess, but we don't fundamentally know because we've never seen this type of shock have to manifest.
Yeah, and I think on the other side of it too, we don't necessarily understand or know what the, let's say, the elasticity or the ability of the consumer to absorb the, you know, the start of those higher prices, never mind where they get to, right? And that goes back to your point about demand destruction from both sides.
Exactly, exactly. And I think that's, again, we know that supply can't jump in quick enough. And I think in the interim, what these prices are doing is the extreme backwardation is trying to draw down stocks of all of these products wherever possible.
Right.
The stocks are temporary. Like, for instance, we know, I was just looking at, I was just doing a call just before this, on jet fuel. And European jet fuel inventories in ARA Europe, Amsterdam, Rotterdam, Antwerp, the main kind of pricing hub for Europe and trading and blending hub for fuels, ended the year last year around 1.1 million tons. So that's, you can multiply that by 7.5, give or take, for your barrels. But that's nearly halved. So now we're at 646,000 tons. So you've halved jet fuel supplies over the past couple months. Mm-hmm. And that theoretically will continue here the longer this goes on. Jet fuel across many parts of the world is one of the tightest products. You see Singapore jet fuel right now, spot prices are still over $200 a barrel. And they jumped there nearly in the first week of the crisis. They've just stayed really high. They haven't gone higher yet. But I think this is these types of things, that these middle distillate products, jet fuel, diesel, et cetera, is where most of that pricing pain is still happening.
Have you seen that in the UK? Because they were saying that they're, you know, running out, or basically the last shipment is headed to the UK momentarily, I believe, wasn't it?
Yes. So I think that is something that we do expect, that, the UK, roughly half of its jet fuel imports came through the Middle East Gulf. We've heard that to continue. And again, I think in the short term, this is going to manifest as shortages because, again, it takes time to reroute the stuff. But eventually, I see Europe being able to incentivize barrels away from other largely poorer areas of the world to kind of clear this in the medium term, that European consumers are always going to be willing to pay more for a flight than someone in West Africa, as an example, or South Asia. Again, this becomes the kind of brutal market logic of a global capitalist traded system, is that he who can pay the most gets the thing. And in this case, the thing is fuel.
Yeah. Excellent, Rory. Well, I really appreciate you laying this all out for us. Is there anything that you'd like to leave our listeners to think about before we wrap up here?
No, I think just keep following keep following the crisis. And as we can see, there's lots of headline volatility on various presidential jawboning efforts. But as of today, Hormuz remains functionally closed, and we're losing 13 million barrels a day of product from the market. So as long as that continues, this crisis will continue to get worse physically. even if financial markets are not fully reflecting that pain thus far.
Absolutely. Of course, for anybody that wants to follow more of your work, your X feed is excellent at Rory_Johnston, Johnston. And of course, excellent Substack as well, commoditycontext.com. Rory, thanks so much for your time today.
Thanks for having me, Tom.